Hello, I'm Lee Gatiss, the editor of The Theologian, www.theologian.org.uk, the internet journal for integrated theology. It's great to have with me today Dr. Ben Cooper, an assistant minister here at St. Helens Bishopsgate in the City of London in the UK. It's great to have you with us today, Ben. Thanks for coming in.
Marvellous to be here. Thank you.
Ben, tell us first, before we get started on some of the serious business of talking about God's sovereign control of the universe, tell us a bit about how you became a Christian.
Quite late in life, actually. So I was 24 at the time. I come from a non-Christian family. I had got married to a non-Christian who also came from a non-Christian family. And it was after about 3 years of our marriage before we even started thinking about it, anything remotely connected to Christianity. It came about because a friend of my wife's, who she was working with in Oxford, was a Christian, and just very patiently, carefully witnessed to us over a couple of years. And we were sort of interested in this and wanted to take it further. He eventually sent us off to see a guy who was a rector of St. Ebb's Church in Oxford at the time.
David Fletcher.
David Fletcher, indeed, who sat us down and with a couple of Bibles, explained the gospel to us. And it is kind of difficult to describe. It was just conviction of sin. I wouldn't have been able to put it into those terms at the time, but it was just an awareness that I couldn't go any further without asking God for forgiveness, and which I did mercifully, and even more mercifully, Catherine did too.
Both right there and then.
Right there and then.
In David Fletcher's living room.
That's right. Which is a marvellous thing.
So you entered the kingdom together at the same time.
We did. We did, which is extraordinary. And we're very, very grateful for that.
And you grew through the ministry of David and others at and Vaughan Roberts at St. Ebb's in Oxford over...
That's right,
yeah. There for many years?
For 2 years.
Right.
And then moved to London, where we came here to St. Helens for a couple of years, so we know a little bit about St. Helens.
What were you doing in Oxford? Were you studying there?
I was studying at the time. I think at the time I was doing an MPhil in economics.
Right. But didn't you end up teaching there as well?
I did, yes. I kind of got a bit stuck there, so I... did an MPhil in economics, then I stayed on and did a DPhil in economics, and then I stayed on to do a postdoc, a research fellowship.
In economics?
In economics, after that. So I did a lot of economics.
Yes. What particularly is your field economically?
Economically, game theory.
Game theory.
Game theory is the theory of interactive decision-making. So, I guess decision-making is quite easy to understand, you know, it's about making decisions. Interactive decision-making, you're making decisions thinking about how other people are going to make decisions. And
didn't this all start with trying to avoid nuclear war or something like that?
They did try to use game theory quite a lot in the 1960s when it came to nuclear war. Perhaps not very well, but...
Well, we avoided nuclear war, which is
we did,
thing.
Which is what we're all thankful for.
So you came then to London, and now you're an ordained minister in the Church of England, so I should really call you Reverend Doctor Ben Cooper. But how did that happen? What was your path to ministry?
To that sort of ministry, indeed. It was a reasonably slow path. So while we were at St. Helens, we got involved in the small groups here, did a bit of small group leading. I was actually there and I met somebody called William Taylor. He was my small group study leader at the time, or a leader of leaders, or however you want to call it. And it actually was him that first suggested thinking about the sort of full-time Christian work stuff. I didn't think at the time, I'd only been Christian for 2 years, so I thought it was a bit early, really. We then moved out of London, just out of London, to a much smaller church in a little town called Chesham.
Right.
And got involved in the ministry there. It was a little bit like doing a part-time apprenticeship, so a lot of chance to get involved in doing preaching, leading services, that sort of stuff, which is a great place to explore whether this was a good idea and get lots of feedback and the support of the church.
Cut your teeth in that sort of ministry a little bit.
Yeah, that's
well.
Right. That's
and then
right.
You went to Oak Hill Theological College?
To Oak Hill, that's right, for 3 years, where we had a splendid time, a really good time.
Great. And then joined the staff here at St. Helens, what, 3 or 4 years ago?
That's right. Just over 3 years ago.
And since then, you've also published a couple of books, a Latimer study and a book through the Good Book Company on the whole subject of why God punishes sin.
That's right.
Doesn't sound like a very cheery subject, Ben. Why have you come to write on that?
It is not a cheery subject. Nevertheless, it is a very important subject.
Mm.
And pretty foundational to the gospel and what we believe. And seems to be the area which has been strongly under attack, I guess, the last couple of centuries, and undermining our confidence in the gospel, our confidence in things like penal substitution, all of these things.
Mm.
And yet there's not a lot of stuff written about it since John Owen, in fact, which was some time ago.
It was a few centuries ago.
That's
right. A friend of mine was emailed me the other day and just asked, what books are there to recommend for people if you're looking at sin and judgment?
Yeah.
And I looked at my bookshelves and there weren't that many.
No, that's right.
There aren't too many books published recently on that.
Yeah, yeah. It's one of the disgraces of Christian publishing is that there are very few books on the cross and very few books on the doctrine underlying the cross as well, the doctrine of punishment, the doctrine of
justice. Well, it's great to have your book now on it. So tell us, why does God punish sin? Why must God punish sin?
Why must God punish sin? So putting it like that is putting it very strongly. So we're saying not just that God is a God who punishes sin, which is very clear from the scriptures, but that he must, it's part of his character to punish sin, which is a much stronger thing. It makes it a much more concrete doctrine, which means that we've got to rely on the cross as a means of salvation. So it is foundational. Why must he? You can approach it from all sorts of different angles. It's probably best first to approach it from the angle of the cross itself. So the very fact that God sent his only son to die to deal with the problem of sin, sent his son to die a punishment-bearing death, which is how we must read the scriptures if we're going to read them seriously. The fact that he did that must surely show that there were no other options for him.
Yes.
So in that sense, it must be the case, you know, that either you were punished outside a relationship with Jesus Christ, or you're punished inside that relationship, but he bears that punishment for you.
Mm. If there was another way, then surely he would have taken it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So the cross itself, right at the heart of the Christian faith, shows us that God must punish sin.
Mm.
We need to delve a little bit deeper to think about, well, still we don't quite understand why that is. We then turn to the fact that God is creator and the source of life, and that sin is turning away from life. So what do you expect but death when you turn away from life? We can look to the fact that God is the just ruler of the world and has a right to rule the world and has a right to clear his name when he's slandered by sin. Because one of the things we do when we sin is to lie about God.
Yeah.
And those lies need to be refuted, and God acts in punishment in part to refute those lies. And we can look to the huge amount of biblical material on the goodness and holiness of God, the fact that he is utterly opposite to evil, utterly opposed to it, and therefore is determined to act against it in practice. And it's very graphic language in the scriptures, but he's determined to act against it with all his power and might. And it's only his patience that's holding it back.
A lot of people focus on God as love, but the scriptures talk even more. More about God as holy.
Yes, that's right.
And just.
That's right. So there are two references in the Bible to God is love, both in 1 John, about 9 or 11 references to God as a consuming fire, to talking about his judgment.
Wow.
So, yeah, that is the balance. Nevertheless, you know, God is love, but in order to understand the fact that God is love, you've got to first understand that he is just.
So just love would be a great name for a book on this subject.
Just love would be ideal.
And it's in fact the name of your book, so that's quite good.
That's quite useful. I didn't think of that title, I had to hasten to that.
Oh. It's a very good title, I would say.
It is.
Well, I know that here at St. Helens, just recently you've been working on the doctrine of God's sovereignty, and we've been teaching something together on that at sort of Sunday school for adults that we've started here at St. Helens before our Sunday morning service. So, thinking about sovereignty, why have you been thinking about that? Why have we been doing a whole course on God's sovereignty?
Well, it's one of those things that is both very hard, and I think all of us at some point will struggle with it, the whole doctrine of how much is God in control of the universe, to what extent is in control. So it's both very hard, but also massively important, sort of foundationally important, a whole load of other things that we also think are important. And not only that, and related to that, the fact that this is a huge pastoral importance, so the way we talk to one another and help each other sort of cope with the ups and downs of life and think about God within all those different circumstances, it seems to have a really big bearing on all those things.
Well, what sort of issues do you find it coming up in conversations here? Prayer?
That's right. So it does come up in conversations. It tends to come up in conversations, I think, especially when people have been going through a rough time personally, or they know people have been going through a rough time. Mm. So to be told in those circumstances that is something that in some sense God ordained or planned is a tough thing to cope with. And so to pastor people effectively in those sorts of circumstances is really very important. Mm.
You have a great story that you garnered from a book by Gregory Boyd, who's an open theist and obviously doesn't take the same sort of view as you and I would on sovereignty. But tell us a bit about that story, because I think it's a great sort of entree into this whole subject and the pastoral importance of it.
That's right. So Gregory Boyd, he is a pastor himself, and he talks about someone he pastored in one of his churches. He calls her Suzanne. That's not her real name, but that's what he calls her. And she'd come to him with a story that went something like this. She'd been brought up in a Christian home. She was a godly, faithful Christian disciple. Mm. She'd married someone whom she thought was a Christian. She'd gone into that marriage prayerfully, and she was convinced that she had God's approval for that. Mm. And yet very soon it had gone horribly wrong. He was very soon in an adulterous relationship. Mm. He left her. He left her pregnant with his child, and the whole thing was a complete disaster and a real mess. Yeah. And I think we can probably, most of us can think of situations where something similarly as horrible has happened to people. Gregory Boyd tries to argue that you cannot pastor to someone in that situation if you hold to a strong view of his sovereignty. And in fact says that only with an open view of God can you say, well, what must have happened in that situation is that God was as much surprised by that turn of events as you were. And that he'd led you into that marriage under the expectations that everything looked good. But then it all went horribly wrong, and he had to change his mind.
God was taken as much by surprise
as she was.
As Suzanne. Yeah. Yeah. Now, you've sort of hinted there are a couple of competing views about God's sovereignty. Two or three views that we've spoken of here in what we've been looking at. Just, do you want to just outline what those are for people? They may not have come across the open view and any other sort of halfway house views that there are.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm thinking about this as a spectrum. At one end of the spectrum, we've got the open view. This is what would be the Gregory Boyd view. Under this view, the future is completely open for God as well as us. So what happens in history is a real drama. We don't know what's going to happen next. God might have a slightly better idea of what's going to happen next than we do, but still he can't be sure because he leaves us in complete control of our own decisions. We're utterly free to do different things at different points. He can't predict perfectly what they're going to be. So history is a drama. So that's the open view.
That's very different from what I was taught.
About God?
About God, yeah. It sounds like a kind of relatively new perspective on God's sovereignty. We all kind of intuitively think maybe God knows everything and
everything about it. So it's quite radical.
Yeah.
It is quite radical. It's been around, I guess. So it was around in the 16th century. Faustus kind of sort of held to this sort of view. Mm-hmm. This would be beating around mostly at the fringes of things. Perhaps more the recent open peer stuff has been slightly more closer to the mainstream.
Right. Who is propagating this sort of view of the open view of God?
It seems to be strongest in the States. I don't really know the current situation. It certainly has been quite strong. So Gregory Boyd, Clark Pinnock in the States, and a number of other people have sort of promoting this view over the last 10 years or so. It seems to have died down a little bit. I don't know. But these things filter around, and you come across it in strange places.
You do. In pastoral situations in churches.
That's right.
So what are the other views?
So that's one end of the spectrum. If we move slightly further along the spectrum, we would have what's sometimes called the Arminian view. So this is after Jacobus Arminius, who came up, who I suppose the clearest statement of this view is that, so it's similar to the open view in that God leaves us fully in control of our decisions.
Right.
But different in that he foreknows what those decisions are going to be.
Hmm.
So God has the qualities we might expect from God in that he knows what's going on and he knows the future and he sort of knows freely what we're going to do. That would be the Arminian view. And that's been a very popular view, actually, through church history. So John Wesley would have held very strongly indeed to that view. And everything stemming out from him in Methodism would have followed that. Later Lutherans also would have held to that view. Not Luther himself, but some later Lutherans would have held to that view, and today as well.
And many people sitting in our churches just hold that as a kind of self-evident view.
That's right. And you come across this in the strangest of circumstances. So you'll be watching films or whatever. And so one of the reasons that Arminius came up with this view is he thought it solved the problem of evil, the problem of how there might be, God might allow evil into the world.
Right.
He thought it put the responsibility of evil on our free decision to do bad things, therefore took the blame away from God. So evil exists in the world, therefore, as the cost of allowing this sort of freedom, this sort of free will.
It's a way of defending God.
Yeah, that's right. So that's what he thought he was doing.
Being unjust, right.
Yeah. So that, I mean, that, which is a big issue. It is an issue we need to deal
with. Where
would
you see this in films? You say you saw it in a film somewhere.
When we do this on Weekends Away, we showed a little bit of Time Bandits, Terry Gilliam's Time Bandits.
Time Bandits.
At the very end of Time Bandits, God appears, and a little boy asks him, "Why do you allow evil into the world?" And he says, "Oh, I can't remember, something to do with free will," and then walks off. So even in film, even in popular culture, yes, you will see this idea coming out.
So there's the open view, the Arminian view. I think there must be another one.
Yeah. You could probably come up with another intermediate view, which would be to say that God is fully in control of things and we're free, and yet we cannot reconcile them. They're an irreconcilable tension. That's quite a popular view as well. But at the far spectrum, we have what you might call the fully closed view. It's sometimes called technically compatibilism, because it tries to show how God's sovereign control over things is compatible with our responsibility for our actions. So this would state that God is in complete control of the universe, every single detail of it, from start to finish, including everyone's decisions, whether they be for the good or whether they be for the bad. And yet, we are still responsible for our actions.
Right.
And the normal way that is defended within the view is to say we're responsible for our actions because we do what we want.
We do what we want. Opposed to what? What's the other way of defining that? We do what someone else wants, or
yeah. So we're free and responsible in that sense. So that's in contrast to the open view or the Arminian view, which is said we're only free if we're actually, from any perspective, actually able to do something else.
Right. So there's sort of two views of what freedom is.
Yeah.
Am I free because I do what I want?
Yeah.
And therefore, I can be judged for it. I'm responsible for it because I done what I wanted to do.
That's right.
As opposed to,
I'm free because I could have done something else. I was free to do something else.
Mm.
And obviously, that way of thinking, free to do something else way of thinking about it, is then incompatible with thinking about God being in control of things.
Right. Why is that?
Because if I'm in control of that decision to that extent, then that's going to squeeze out God's control of it. So he has to somehow stand back from that.
So if I think I made a decision, I was free to do something else, I could have done something else, but I also believe that God is entirely sovereign over everything, including my decisions, then you're saying somehow I'm inconsistent.
I am saying you're inconsistent. Now, some people are happy to hang on to that inconsistency, and you'll come across people talking about that. I think it's a pretty strong inconsistency myself. Now, sometimes, of course, you know, some things are a mystery in Christian doctrine, plenty of that around. You have to ask the question when you've got as big an inconsistency as that, is, you know, can we go back to the scriptures and try and work this out a bit better. Does God say anything that helps us to reconcile those two things?
So who's holding this more closed view? We talked about the open view as people like Clark Pinnock, Rice, Sanders, and Gregory Boyd. Then there's the Arminian view, Wesley, and others like that. Who's holding this closed, fully closed view today?
Well, it's something that runs through the whole of church history. So in early church history, it would be Augustine who would have stated it most clearly and strongly.
Mm-hmm.
It was then restated, I guess, at the time of the Reformation, in contrast to medieval doctrine, which had sort of wandered off in various different directions, were restated in the Reformation, most notably and infamously by John Calvin, which is why this view is often called Calvinism.
Right.
But it's been taken on by Reformed doctrine since then. So you get a whole range of modern theologians who would hold to from that stream coming out from John Calvin.
And that's the kind of view enshrined in things like the Westminster Confession of Faith, the 39 Articles of Religion in the Church of England.
Yes, that's right. The 39 Articles aren't completely tight on it, but that's what they imply, at least.
Yeah. There were some attempts to tighten up on the 39 Articles.
There were,
the Lambeth Articles, but they didn't succeed in being
quite tightened up. That's right. Okay. So the 39 Articles are almost there, but not quite.
They're certainly consistent with the Calvinist understanding, aren't they?
That's right.
It may allow some Arminianism to creep
in. That's right.
So let's think about the biblical basis for some of these views. Why would someone... I mean, Clark Pinnock has... used to be a Calvinist and then became an Arminian and now is an open theist, but he's clearly someone who knows the Bible and has read the Bible, and it's important for him. Where is he looking in the Bible to find the sort of open theist, open view of God? What passages are important to the open theists?
Well, there are many places that guys like that would point to, and you read their books and they're full of Bible references.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that we have to deal with fairly and try and deal with properly. So, for example, there are many places, especially in narrative passages of the Bible, where God is interacting with people, where it certainly does seem that he changes his mind. In fact, that very word is used. God changed his mind. So as God interacts with Moses in Exodus 32, and they have a bit of an interchange.
Mm-hmm. After the golden calf?
After the golden calf, about who are going to be the people of God. Is God going to stick with these people, or is he going to start with a new people with Moses? There's a bit of an interchange over that.
Mm-hmm.
And the phrase is there. God relented. God changed his mind.
Yeah.
And other places you could look where it seems like God's knowledge has increased. So it seems that God is testing people in order to find out more about them. So a lot of passages where the sort of you might call them relational passages within narrative, where God is interacting with someone and there seems to be a change of mind or a change of knowledge, which are at least consistent with the open view and seem to sort of push in that direction.
Mm.
For Clark Pinnock, it seems to be in the warning passages in the New Testament that...
particularly Hebrews, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right, particularly in Hebrews. I suppose that might well be true for John Wesley as well. Would have pushed him in that direction, pushed him in an Arminian direction. So these are passages in the New Testament which seem to be addressed to true Christians who've had a true experience of salvation, warning them not to turn away, warning them to keep persevering, and being very explicit about the consequences if they don't. Now, under Pinnock's understanding, that is inconsistent with a Calvinist understanding of where they're going.
Hmm. There is, of course, an article on The Theologian about the warning passages in Hebrews, which readers, listeners, can click on and read a bit more about that. So you're saying Arminians and open theists will use those kind of relational passages, Exodus 32 and other places in the New Testament, like Hebrews, to defend their view and to say this is biblical. So they're not just defending it on philosophical grounds. It's what they think is the Bible's view. Closed theists, can we call that Calvinists? Those with a fully closed view of God's sovereignty. What are they pointing to in the Bible as a sort of counter to that?
Well, the biblical material on God's sovereign control is even more extensive.
Hmm.
And if you were to sort of I know this is not the way to do doctrine, but if you were to put in the scales all the material which seems to suggest an open view and all the material on the other side which seems to suggest a closed view, we'd go very heavily in terms of the closed view, the sheer quantity and quality and depth, rather, of the material that suggests that God is in control of things, in control of history, is overwhelming. Not just individual verses that you can point to, but the whole thrust of whole books of the Bible seems to be pushing in that direction.
Such as? Which books are you thinking of?
So the book of Genesis, which is interestingly has some passages that might support an open view. Mm-hmm. But the book as a whole is God as creator is in control, and the book ends with the statement, all the bad things that have been happening to Joseph in that story happened to under God's providence and for good, even though it didn't look that way. And you'll see similar things throughout the book as sort of statements of that God is in control, God is in control.
Yes. I was speaking to somebody about this when we were talking about it a few weeks ago, in very early morning on a Sunday here at St. Helens, and they said to me, I can't understand this open view of God, because when I first became a Christian, which was very recently, she'd read through the whole of Acts and Romans in a couple of days, and she said it just screamed out to me, God is in control, God is in control. Right. And so she couldn't quite understand why anyone had read those books would think that.
Yeah, that's right. So it's very strong in the book of Acts. You know, God is providentially in control of the gospel going out against every obstacle and is controlling that at every step.
And the
step.
Reverses as well. You said, so the whole books you think are thrust in that direction, the reverses or passages. Where are the classic places we would look for the closed view?
So a classic verse would be Ephesians 1:11. God works all things according to the counsel of his will. Mm. It's just a general statement from the Apostle Paul about how God works in the world. And it's working. It's not just knowing about stuff. It's working. It's that type of control. Mm. And in the detail of individual people, it's not just about knowing. It's very difficult to sustain that it's just about knowing when you see God intervening in Pharaoh, for example, in the Old Testament, or Judas in the New. It's God intervening and controlling people's decisions according to his plans and purposes. Mm. So Acts 2:21, is it? Not just according to his foreknowledge, but also according to his plan and purpose.
His definite plan and purpose, as it's often translated. Yeah, that's right. Well, how do we cut this Gordian knot, as it were, and this difficult issue then of if God is completely in control, can I really be held responsible for my actions? I've heard you talk about the view of freedom. Yeah. So we talk about it as if we are responsible because we did what we wanted, rather than just we could have done otherwise. And that's that view of freedom which then show, I can be held responsible, because I still did what my heart and my mind decided to do, even though God was also behind that. But I've also heard you talk about something called the two viewpoints solution, which is a very grand title for this. Tell me about the two viewpoints solution to this issue.
The two viewpoint solution is an attempt to try and reconcile some of this stuff and trying to deal with some of these problems.
Mm.
Let's try and tackle them one by one. So we try and tackle. So one problem we have is our feelings and intuition about freedom and responsibility. Now we turn to the Bible, and actually it's very hard to find a very sort of explicit, straightforward definition of freedom and responsibility. We might say that there's a lot that's implied in stuff that's said, but you can't take a simple statement. But we will search in vain for the open understanding of freedom. We're not going to find anywhere in the Bible that says, in order to be free, you have to be able to do otherwise. We might come across something a little bit like the way that a Calvinist might think about it. So Mark chapter 7, for example, your evil actions come out from your heart. They are evil because your heart, which is where you choose what to do, is corrupt. So you are held responsible because what you wanted to do, you did do, and it was evil.
And it was in your heart.
And it was in your heart. You know, there's that sort of connection. So that does tend to support the Calvinist view much, much more strongly. The problem we have, that although all of that is true, that we could simply just go for the Calvinist view and just leave it at that and say, look, you've got to accept what the Bible says. Mm. Still, we're quite reluctant to do that. And in pastoral situations where this is coming up, people are very wedded to the idea that they need to be able to do otherwise. So we did a survey on the stuff we did on Sunday mornings recently. And it's very interesting that you ask people what they think about freedom and responsibility, and they'll always, pretty much always, go for the open view, even if they hold to a closed view on God's sovereignty.
So people have a closed view of God's sovereignty. They think God is in control of everything. And they tick that.
Yeah.
But then when you ask them about freedom,
they'll tick the open view on freedom.
Right. Without realizing the inconsistency.
Very often without realizing the inconsistency. That's right. So that's the first issue that the two viewpoint solution tries to address. It tries to address it by going back to the doctrine of God as creator and us as his creatures. I think this is what we've got to come back to understand God's sovereignty. It's something that's obviously flagged up in the very first verse of the Bible and runs all the way through it like the writing through a stick of rock and is cropping up time and time again as an assumed everywhere. And I rather suspect that the biblical writers assume us to have a better grip of this and a stronger understanding of this than we probably do, which is perhaps why they don't address the issues in quite the way that we want them to. But nevertheless, the issue is addressed through that doctrine. God is creator. He creates from nothing so that everything that exists or happens is in the end there or happens because he chose it for it to be so. Now, that automatically, I think, gives us a pretty strong view of God's sovereignty. But it also gives us, that is also God giving us a framework for thinking about his sovereignty and our choices in a coherent way.
So the two viewpoints are God's viewpoint and my viewpoint as a human, as a creature.
As a creature, that is the key distinction.
So the key distinction is to think about God as creator and therefore controller.
That's right.
And me as creature.
And me as creature, that's right. So people, you could misunderstand, this isn't relativism. It's not like it's okay to hold two opposing views that are contradictory or whatever. It's just, in fact, in many ways, it's the opposite of relativism, because it's accepting that God is the one who sets truth, who sets the agenda, who knows everything, who chooses everything as creator, and that my status as a creature is to submit to that and to acknowledge my very different relative status, to not play God, and to accept the differences that involves.
So you're not saying there are two views of truth in the Bible?
Absolutely not.
In a postmodern sort of way?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
There's one truth. God defines what it is.
Yeah, that's right. But there are differences in what you know. So God, as creator, because he's created everything, knows everything. So there's that completeness to his knowledge, knowing the end from the beginning, as it says in Isaiah 46. But our status as creatures is very, very different to that. And I think one of the key things, the differences in our place as a creature, is that while God has this exhaustive knowledge over all things, we know much less. You know, we're set at a point in space and time. We've got some knowledge of stuff that's going around us, some knowledge of stuff that's happened in the past, but in particular, the future is close to us. We don't know it in the same way that God has created you.
So we'll prepare for all things as unknown.
We will prepare for things as unknown, and I think this really helps us to understand how we face decisions. As if they were open. In fact, to us they are open because God has kept that knowledge from us.
So it does seem to me as if I could have done otherwise.
Yeah, exactly. That's what thinking about this framework helps us to see. In other words, what we're doing there is rehabilitating some of the intuitions about freedom and responsibility that we're very wedded to, and just, you know, tweaking them a bit, so that they can fit in and be compatible with God's sovereign control.
So although my freedom isn't defined as I could have done otherwise, because that can't be true in God's universe, it must have happened. It must happen the way it happens, because God has ordained whatsoever comes to pass. It does feel to me as if, from my creaturely perspective, that I could have done otherwise. From my small perspective, I feel that.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
That's helpful because it integrates my intuition and my perspective on things with the larger view that God gives in His Word right. and in that way.
It means that we can look back on our decisions and we can say, "Yeah, that was my decision." I hold up my hand and say, "That was one of mine." Not just because it's what I wanted to do, but because back when I was doing it, so far as I knew at the time, I could have done something different. Yeah, I did that bad thing. I wanted to do that bad thing. So far as I knew at the time, I could have done the good thing. Therefore, I'm responsible. Mm. It's right that I be held responsible for doing that bad thing.
Well, let's think about the practical application of this. Let's go back to the story you told us about Gregory Boyd and this lady Suzanne who thought she had guidance from God or assurance from God that she should marry the guy who then went off and committed adultery and left her. What do we say in that situation? It's a dreadful pastoral situation. How do you deal with that from a Calvinist perspective as opposed to what seems like the more fluffy and helpful, reassuring, open perspective?
Yeah.
What can we say?
Yeah, I know that's right. I think there are probably two issues in Suzanne's story. One is the issue of guidance and our expectations in the Christian life and how we make decisions. And there's also the problem of evil. You know, so how does a good God allow wicked things like that to happen to people or to happen in general? You know, so we just separate those two issues out. There's quite a lot I think you could say on the guidance side of things. So Suzanne's claim was that she felt she had God's approval for that marriage. I think if we were pastoring her, we'd want to ask her about that, about whether God does promise to intervene in that sort of way and give that sort of direct approval for what she's doing. What the two perspectives helps us to see is that as creatures, God is deliberately keeping the future from us in many ways. He has the exhaustive view of the future. We don't. So it's we don't like that very often.
No.
So we're very often wanting that glimpse into the future, that sign or that word. And presumably that was what Suzanne was after at the time. But it is part of being a creature to face those decisions unexpected, you know, without knowing exactly what's going to happen.
Yes.
And yet, but it's not that God has left us in the dark in those situations. He's told us exactly what to do. He's given us the scriptures. And Paul is very, very clear that the scriptures are sufficient. They are enough to equip us to do every good work, not just some good works, but every good work. So it's 2 Timothy 3:17. Mm. So pastoring along those sorts of lines would help a little, I think. And taking her to Jesus Christ for the expectations of the Christian life. So God doesn't promise us perfect marriages or for a perfect sign of approval that a certain marriage is going to work. But he does promise us that as we follow Jesus Christ, there is at least a possibility that we're going to suffer as he suffered, that we may even suffer betrayal and rejection and evil in a way that he suffered those things. So I think pastorally the most sensitive thing to do would be to take her to Jesus and say what you experienced in that rejection and in that damaged relationship in your marriage was exactly what Jesus was experiencing on the cross. It was part of Christian experience to go through those sorts of things.
We have a high priest who can sympathise with us in every weakness. He
Absolutely.
Knows what it's like.
That's right.
What about some of the other issues that often crop up when we're talking about God's control of the universe? There's the classic book by Jim Packer, Evangelism and the Sovereignty of God. How does this two-viewpoint solution and the view of freedom we've been talking about, how does that help us think about why bother evangelizing if God's going to save who he wants to save anyway?
Yeah.
Why should I play my part? He's going to do what he wants. He's in charge.
Yeah.
I'll just sit back and watch him do it, shall I?
Yeah. Now, there's obviously a huge amount we could say about evangelism in general, and I think probably only part of it pertains to the issue of sovereignty. Mm. So God does command us to evangelize, right, certainly as a church, and certainly as individuals. He commands us to be open Christians, and that we're always prepared to be expressing our Christianity in different places and being open about it.
Ready to give an answer to anyone who asks us while we have hope.
Yeah, yeah. And I think everyone ready with the gospel, you know, and delighted to be passing on the gospel. Mm. So that all those things will apply regardless of what you think about God's sovereignty. The two viewpoints, if the two viewpoints view has any contribution here at all, is that it helps us to remember that although God knows who are his, we don't.
We're just creatures.
Yeah, that's right. So if I go into an evangelistic interaction with someone, I do not know. I genuinely do not know where they're going to be. So there is a from my point of view, there's a genuine possibility that this is.
They are elect. That
this is the moment. This is the means that God has chosen to actually make that happen.
So actually, our evangelism is the means by which God achieves His sovereign purpose.
Yeah, that's right.
Right.
And actually, that takes away a lot of the anxiety in evangelism. It's very interesting. And John Chapman, who's a famous Australian evangelist, you may know, came to talk to us about evangelism. And the thing he started with, strangely, you might have expected him to do this, was God's sovereignty. If we didn't have the doctrine of God's sovereignty behind us, going into an evangelistic situation would be utterly terrifying, because this person's fate, whether they went into heaven or hell, would be based on our performance in that interaction. Mm. That would be almost impossible.
Guilt-ridden. I'd be totally guilt-ridden.
That's right.
Utterly stressed out my entire life if that was the case.
I think this is what you see a little bit in John Wesley, who was a great man in many ways, but he just seemed to be sort of driven by this fear all the time. And there are also some very good things about what he did, but it's much better to be able to, have the confidence that you've got the sovereign God behind you when you go into an evangelistic situation.
So God's sovereignty doesn't mean that I should sit back and take it easy. It means we want to encourage great evangelistic endeavours.
Yeah.
George Whitfield, of course, Wesley's companion, did hold to this more closed view of God's sovereignty and was a great evangelist.
That's right. And it motivated him to evangelise. He had the power of God to call on as he evangelised.
I think prayer is a similar quandary that people often have. If God knows already what I want, what I need, and what He's going to give me, then why do I need to ask for it? What is my part? Why should I bother praying? If that's the case, if God's already decided, it's a bit like Tony Blair going to the Commons and presenting his plans for Trident, which he's already decided he's going to push through, and inviting debate, which he's not really going to listen to. Isn't God like that? That's a very political point. But you see the idea. Is God really wanting us to pray?
Yeah. Well, in a similar way to the evangelism issue, there's a lot about prayer that we could say that wouldn't necessarily be affected by our views on God's sovereignty. So we can say that, again, God commands us to pray and teaches us how to, and Jesus teaches in the Sermon on the Mount how to pray. And the big implication is that you should be praying. You know, so we respond to that command to pray, regardless of what we think about these things. We're remembering that in prayer isn't just about, prayer certainly isn't about trying to mould God's will to my will, so asking for things in that sort of sense. There's much more of a sense of this being a process which God uses to change me and bring me in line with His will. So the Lord's Prayer is very much along those lines. So it's your will be done. Mm. We're submitting to all this. So it's not just the asking side. Does the two viewpoints view help on these things? Well, it helps in the sense that, again, under the two viewpoints, you're reminded that you do not know certain specifics and detail about the future. Mm. But God does. That should then motivate you to pray, because you're praying to the person who does know about those things. Mm-hmm. They're not fixed and sealed so far as you know. So again, you can. It's possible for you to think about, well, the thing that might happen, that God has planned to happen here, is that I pray about it, then this thing this thing will change.
Yeah.
So that should motivate us to pray about a whole host of things that we, again, we don't know what the future is, but God does.
Is that, again, prayer as a means of grace, that this could be the means through which God works?
Yes, that's right. That's right.
The means through which he encourages me to keep going. He encourages me to pray a particular thing, and then he does it as a way of saying...
Yeah, that's right. So we can see an interaction. We can see a relationship going, a genuine relationship going on. So we have prayers answered.
Mm.
And that is greatly reassuring for us. Yeah.
It's greatly reassuring that God isn't just the kind of God who can have his arm twisted by my emotional prayers or my hours and hours of intercession. He's not bamboozled by that or manipulated by that.
So everything he's done is according to his settled, chosen plan.
Mm.
And yet he is still responsive. Mm. I think that's one of the two viewpoints. Solution will helps you to sort of think through a little bit.
And I like the way you say, hey, we're commanded to evangelize, we're commanded to pray. So regardless of what we think about the bigger issues, it's there in Scripture that we should do these things.
Yeah.
So even if we don't fully understand all that we've been talking about this afternoon, then we're still commanded to pray. So
absolutely.
Get on and do it, and don't worry about how it fits in with these bigger things if you can't quite see it at the moment. Just keep
working.
That's right.
I think the sovereignty issue is an issue like that. That a lot of us do struggle with it, but it's one of those issues you have to have on the back burner of your thoughts. It's not that it's unimportant, as we've been saying, but we have to say, if we don't understand it, I don't quite understand this. But if I don't understand it, Lord, the problem's with me, not with you.
Yeah.
I'll have this on the back burner. I'll be chewing it over. I'll be trying to deal with it. I know it's important, but Lord, help me to keep going as a Christian. Don't let this trip me up. Keep me praying. Keep me evangelizing. Keep me reading the Scriptures.
Mm. What's good to read on this? I mean, obviously the Scriptures will teach us this. My friend who said, just read Acts and Romans, and it's very clear. But are there other books? I think your view of freedom, the freedom of the will, has been influenced greatly by Jonathan Edwards. Is that
yes.
Right?
So Jonathan Edwards, The Freedom of the Will, is a classic book. It is not an easy book to read by any stretch of the imagination. But the first part of that, so part one of The Freedom of the Will, which is not so long, will take you a little while to wade through, but is absolutely excellent. And a lot of the things I've said are actually already there in Jonathan Edwards.
Mm. I found Bruce Ware's book, God's Lesser Glory. It's very good at dealing with the open theists.
Yes.
You're very charitable.
Yeah,
dealing
I think
with
so.
It. He's very gentle and gracious towards them.
Yeah, so good. that's an excellent book. Excellent book.
Other things that you found helpful?
John Frame. Especially John Frame's big book is the Doctrine of God book. It's got the first 150 pages of those are basically addressed to the issue of God's sovereignty. Mm. He does that in a very careful and clear and easy to read way.
He has a book specifically on open.
He does, which is a sort of condensed version of that.
Ah, okay.
He doesn't deal with quite so many of the related issues.
Right.
So the doctrine of God is the one to go for.
Great. Thank you. What else are you reading, Ben, at the moment? We've come to the end of the sort of discussion of sovereignty and those sort of things. What else are you reading at the moment? What's of interest theologically to you?
I'm trying to read some Tom Wright at the moment.
Right.
I'm hoping to do some thinking and writing on the new perspective on Paul next year.
What do you think of Wright? What's your gut feeling from what you've read so far? Are you reading New Testament and the people of God?
That's right,
what's
yes.
What's Paul really said?
Yes,
that sort of thing?
Yes, that's right. I don't want to prejudge it in some ways. My initial impression is that he is very worth reading. And it's very stimulating stuff. He is particularly good on the sort of challenging us to think about the big picture of Scripture and how it all fits together, whether that be in individual books or the whole Scriptures together. So I think there are lots of good challenging things there.
He's a great communicator.
He's a very good
in person and in writing.
That's right. And he writes beautifully, which I wish we could say for more people, including myself. So he writes beautifully. I mean, there are things there which I'm not sure about, and I'm going to want to think about carefully before taking on board. But that's one of my projects for next half year or so.
Interesting. Well, we look forward to the fruits of that, I should think. You're going to be moving from Britain, from the UK, for a few years.
That is the plan. Of course, only God knows.
But you make your plans as a creature and commit them to him.
That's right. If it is God's will.
What are you going to be doing?
The idea is to go to Australia, to Moore College in Sydney for a couple of years to do a PhD there, Biblical Studies PhD. That's what I'm planning to do next.
Brilliant. Okay, well, we look forward to the fruits of that too. Matthew's Gospel, I think, is one of your particular interests.
That is right, Matthew's Gospel.
And you're going to be looking at that with Peter Bolt?
With Peter Bolt.
Terrific, yeah. Great. Well, thank you for joining us today, Ben. It's been great to have your insight on God's sovereignty, and I hope we'll be able to interview you again, or at least have some more things by you on The Theologian. There should be an article by Ben on The Theologian on divine choices and our choices and that sort of thing very soon. So do look for that article on the doctrine section of The Theologian. And do look for other interesting interviews and articles by many different authors in the next few weeks. Thanks very much, Ben, for joining us. Thanks to James Taylor, our audio sub-editor, for all his technical assistance.